There's a little-known story from World War II of an elite all-black paratrooper battalion that served an important mission in Oregon. My two guests will provide more background and details. Joining me in the studio is Murray Taylor. He's a retired smoke jumper with the Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service in Oregon after 26 seasons. He's also author of Jumping Fire, a smoke jumper's memoir of fighting wildfire. Welcome to The Exchange, Murray.
Mike, it's a pleasure.
And joining me by phone is Dr. Robert Bartlett. He's a researcher, writer, and storyteller. He holds a PhD in leadership studies from Gonzaga University and is a retired faculty member. Dr. Bartlett is also a veteran of the Vietnam War and a life member of the 555th Parachute Infantry Association and National Smoke Jumpers Association. He's been telling the story of the Triple Nickels for a decade. Welcome, Dr. Bartlett.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So, gentlemen, I've lived in Oregon for more than 20 years, and I've never heard of the Triple Nickels. So I'm excited to hear this story. Now, I often start the exchange by asking my guests to give me some background, but what I'm going to do, because this story is so fascinating and I want to dive right into it, I'm going to save that for the other side of the break, okay? So my first question is, what are the Triple Nickels?
I'm going to let Bob take this because he knows more of the early history.
Sure. Let me jump in. And again, thanks for having me on the show. The Triple Nickel came about in 1943 as a result of, well, World War II, but also directly because of President Roosevelt, who was instrumental in helping the Tuskegee Airmen come about, famous black pilot unit. Roosevelt was being pressured by his advisory group, Negro advisory group, to make it possible for more black troops to enter the war. So he paid a visit to the airborne school at Benning and asked where their black paratroopers were. And of course, there weren't any. So that put pressure on General Gather, who was the commander, to do something. The Triple Nickel came about when he was getting some pressure, the general, to do something. He approached an NCO, non-commissioned officer, by the name of Walter Morris, who was there in charge of a service company, an all-black service company. So the Triple Nickel short story is General Gather voluntold Walter Morris to put together a group of men from his service company, the all-black service company, to become a test platoon of 20 black troops to go through airborne school.
Okay. Let me ask you this, Dr. Yeah. Bartlett. Explain very quickly what is a service company and also what are paratroopers?
Sure. Okay. Let's start with the service company. The service company that Walter Morris was in charge of did exactly that. They patched roads. They drove trucks. They guarded the gate. They did laundry, so on and so forth. They were a service company. They were not being trained as combat troops. And the second part of your question was, what's a paratrooper? Well, paratrooper is the name that the Army gave men at that time that would be willing to jump out of a perfectly good airplane at level flight and go into combat being deployed by a parachute.
Okay, so at this point in the story, we have a president who's trying to find more help in the paratroopers, right. And they found this help in the service Corps.
Correct.
Okay.
That was their initial attempt to make a difference. So Walter Morris and his 20 men marched literally across the street because we all know that when bombs rained down on Pearl Harbor, the United States of America was harshly segregated. And the military was also harshly segregated. And so these men made history the moment they walked across the street from the all-black part of Fort Benning, which was the service company, to the white part of the base, which was where white troops trained every day as paratroopers. And so the triple nickel came about because of those 20 men who, against all odds, made history by graduating from airborne school, getting their silver wings. They were all enlisted men. All of them were enlisted. So then they graduated, and they were given the title of a company as they grew in numbers, and it was the 555, so 555th Parachute Infantry Company. The men who later were recruited to join this particular company, majority of them came from the 92nd out of Fort Huachuca, New Mexico, which was an all-black Buffalo unit. So if you're familiar with the nickel, the Buffalo nickel is the only coin and currency that has a buffalo on it. I should have said that differently, but you get my point. And so the men, in honor of the Buffalo soldiers that would make up the majority of the battalion that they later would grow into, adopted the Buffalo nickel as their logo. So if you see three welded nickels together with the buffalo showing, that's a triple nickel person.
Okay. My guess.
So that's how they ended up with the name.
Okay. My guests are Murray Taylor, a retired smoke jumper with the BLM and Forest Service in Oregon and author of Jumping Fire, a smoke jumper's memoir of fighting wildfire, and Dr. Robert Bob Bartlett, a Vietnam vet and retired faculty member at Gonzaga University, and he's telling us the story of the triple nickels. Now, we understand they're the 555, the 555th paratrooper unit. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And they're known as the triple nickels, and they came out of a service corps, and they passed the paratrooper school. And how did they get assigned?
Well, their first job then was to build their numbers, and they were left to do that on their own. Now, just a very quick note here: the military at that time, there were black units. My father served in one. His brother served in one. They were combat medics in World War II. The men in the units typically were all black, but the officers were all white. When this particular unit came together, they decided, all right, you're going to be black from bottom to top, basically from the lowest ranking person to the highest ranking person. There's not going to be any white leadership here. So Walter Morris and his group then were given the charge to go out there and find the men to build your numbers. And so then Bradley Biggs enters the picture, who was a lieutenant, and a cadre of six black lieutenants at that time were recruited to go to airborne school, the first ever. And so they graduated. So together with the six, and then you had roughly 17 to 20 black enlisted men, they went out and started building the numbers. And most of the men, as I mentioned, came from Fort Huachuca. So then they were assigned to a place called Camp McCall in North Carolina. And so all of these men were assigned there to build and to train because, again, to go airborne, all but guaranteed that you were going to see combat. And these men all wanted to see combat.
And what kind of training did they receive?
Well, first of all, they had to do advanced infantry training, and they had to do training as to what to do once you exit, you know, how to exit the airplane and all of that as a combat unit, and then how to operate as a paratrooper unit on the ground. And so that's all advanced training. There's different communication styles. There's different ways that they enter into the theater for combat. First of all, you're falling from the sky, right, under a parachute. But from that point on, that takes advanced training because you're likely to get, again, in a combat situation, you're likely to get scattered over some terrain.
Okay.
Unlike Murray can tell you, smoke jumpers is a very different, very, very different thing. So they trained as combat airborne soldiers.
What years are we talking about, and when did they get their first assignment?
They were at Camp McCall training and anxious to go overseas. They were waiting on orders. The 82nd Airborne was getting beat up overseas. At that point, they thought they would go. They did not receive orders until spring, and then June. And when they did receive orders, and this now we're talking 1945,
summer.
Correct. We're talking summer of 1945. Their orders came in the spring. But finally, they get orders that are marked classified. So this was an interesting thing. They could not open the orders. They had no idea what the orders were about, other than they were told to get on a troop train, and their destination was Pendleton, Oregon.
Pendleton, Oregon.
So, yeah, story has it that the men thought they were going to go to Japan, that they were actually going to go to Japan and slip in with MacArthur and that this was some secret mission. They were actually going to get overseas. And I'm sorry, I had that date wrong. It's actually May. Okay. When they left Camp McCall in May and they were assigned to Pendleton, Oregon, only to know that they were going by troop train. Okay. They didn't know how long they were going to be there. They thought they were on their way somewhere else. And so there were lots of rumors. And so they end up in Pendleton.
So Pendleton, Oregon,
in May of 1945.
So Pendleton, Oregon is a couple of hundred miles east of Portland.
Yes.
So now they're in Oregon.
Now they're in Oregon.
Why?
And there was a military base there, Pendleton Field. Actually, Pendleton Field had been a training place for Jimmy Doolittle and his Raiders before the Triple Nickel arrived. By the time the Triple Nickel arrived at Pendleton, in Pendleton, the base had been skeletonized, meaning there was a white commander and basically a maintenance company, just a unit there to keep up the airfield and to do some maintenance on vehicles. That's all that was there. Obviously, there was a hangar and all of that. So the men were assigned there, and mainly because there was no one basically there. So they were given that assignment, Pendleton Field, and still they thought, okay, we're not going to be here long. But they quickly learned that their assignment that was secret was called Operation Firefly. And they were told their mission was going to be twofold. And they also, by the way, met the Forest Service, and this is where Murray comes in, and the Smoke Jumper Program. They were, of course, met by the Army that read their orders to them, which they were in shock and all about. But their goal was the demolition of the destruction of balloon bombs, which they had no idea that actually existed. No one really did, except the military. We were being bombed by the Japanese by balloon bombs.
Hold that point right there. I've got about 90 seconds before I have to take a break, and we're going to pick this up on the other side of the break. But I just want to clarify. So they got secret orders. They're sent over to, and this is an all-black paratrooper unit.
Yep.
They're sent
to
Pendleton, Oregon.
Yep.
And they open the orders, and they're told they have to go find and defuse balloon bombs sent by Japan?
Yes. The Japanese had been sending balloon bombs called Fugos, launching them in Japan. And these bombs these balloons were 33 feet in diameter, 33 to 36 feet, made out of paper. But they were just like a typical hot air balloon, except they carried explosives. And they launched them from Japan because they discovered the jet stream, the Pacific jet stream. So these balloons were flying across the Pacific. It took days, right? And then they were designed to come down and explode. And the plan was, Japanese plan at that time, was to burn the entire west coast of the United States. And they did this all in secret.
So how many balloons are we talking about?
Well, they're somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 eventually. We're talking thousands.
Gotcha.
Thousands of balloons. They launched them over about a year and a half. Thousands of them. And they flew all over the country. Now, people would see them, and when they did see them or find one, the military would swoop in, wear them to secrecy, and take the material. And this all was happening without a lot of public attention because the military was very quick to suppress the news. So they knew this was happening, but they had two objectives, the Army, the military. two objectives. One, they did not want the American people to panic that we were actually being bombed by Japan at the time. The second thing was they did not want the Japanese to know that these balloons were actually happening, that they were actually making it. And so their objective was twofold. And I wanted to go back real quick to say this. I mentioned that the triple nickel were given two directives, and the one was, you know, to do this thing that they'd never even heard of before, to do this job. And the second was to do something they'd never heard of before, and that's the suppression of wildfires. So the two directives were to address the balloon bomb issue, and the second was the suppression of wildfires.
Okay, so
those were their two directives.
This is interesting because you're telling me that this service crew that ultimately became a combat-trained paratrooper team is now in Pendleton, Oregon, and their secret orders they discover is they have to defuse bombs and put out wildfires.
Yes, by air. So they were airborne. They knew how to leave an airplane, but they had to be trained, as Murray can tell you, it's a whole different skill set to be a wildland firefighter. And it was a different skill set to know what these balloon bombs were about. What do you mean? The what bombs? And so they were trained hurriedly to do this mission.
Okay.
7 days were...
Hold on. So now you have to jump out of a plane, find a bomb, defuse the bomb. If the bomb is exploded and there's a wildfire ongoing, you got to put that out. None of which they've been trained for, and now you have to be trained in a hurry to do this job.
Exactly. And by the way, there were 300 of them, give or take, that made that trip from Camp McCall and are sitting in Pendleton. So they were hurriedly trained by the U.S. Forest Service. Members of the U.S. Forest Service came in that were part of the Smoke Jumper program, trained them how to become a smoke jumper, which Murray can tell you, it takes a lot longer than 7 days. But they were hurriedly trained to do that job. And then the military, the last part of their job was which fire to cut if they come across one of these bombs. You know, which one to, or whether to blow it up, whether to defuse it, whatever, and to collect all the information. So that was the initial orientation to their new job in Pendleton. Once they were trained now, real quick, once they were trained, 100 of them were sent to Chico, California, which there was another base in Chico, California. 100 of them, after training, were sent there to do the same job that the others would stay in Pendleton to do.
Okay,
would spend their entire time there. Mm-hmm.
That's just south of Redding.
Yes.
Okay. So now we've got a paratrooper unit, all black, in Pendleton, Oregon, and we've got another portion of that down in Northern California in Chico.
Correct.
And they're trying to locate Japanese bombs that were floated over here through the jet stream in order to explode. Right. And wherever they find these bombs, either defuse them or if the land is on fire, put out the fire.
Either or.
Okay. So, Murray,
this is a very complicated story.
You are a smoke. You were a smoke jumper. Tell me about this job.
Well, smoke jumpers are trained to parachute into extremely remote areas where there's no roads, you know, or access by any other means. In a case of Alaska and some of Canada, even so far that helicopters would have a hard time getting out and back. But anyway, that's what I did for 26 seasons, and I did it in all 7 of the western states, and most of it up in Alaska, and some even over in the Yukon Territory a couple times. I love the idea of being able to talk about the triple nickels. This is, to me, an iconic story of all the best we hope out of our fellow man.
Did you ever get a chance to meet any of them?
I did, and I'm so proud to say that I met in person Walter Morris. And Joe Murchison in 2000 at the big Redding 60-year celebration of smoke jumping. And I met Dick Green. And Brad Biggs wrote this wonderful book, The Triple Nickels. And for your audience, anyone interested in seeing more about this, just type in a search, The Triple Nickels Black Paratroopers. There's some wonderful photos, and there's a wonderful video that Bob helped make, about a four-minute one that really tells what I consider to be the love story of this group. Let me tell you quickly. To me, this is a very romantic story. This was from Walter Morris. Walter stopped in the Boise Interagency Fire Center about 1995. He knew there were jumpers there, and he gave a presentation that was recorded in video. And then it was shared with Alaska. And when at that time, I was the smoke jumper editor for Wildfire Magazine. And I said, I got to get a hold of this guy. And so I did. And Walter wrote a piece for me for Wildfire Magazine. Later, I met him in 2000 at Reading there, along with Joe, who was – Joe Murchison was the current president, and Dick Green lived in the Bay Area. Let me tell you what, Walter, I'm so proud to have this. Walter was 6'2", 180 pounds, muscular and very handsome, and moved with a graceful movement. He was an athlete for sure. But he wrote this to me, to Murray, thanks for the Wildfire. I hope to see you in person one day. Keep up the good work, Walter Morris. P.S. It's surprising that so many people are unaware of our 555th small contribution to the war effort.
Now, just so the audience knows, Murray is holding a book, and he's reading handwritten notes from that book.
Yes, and Walter Morris, as mentioned by Bob, was one of the main drivers. And then Bradley Biggs, bless his heart, he was the author. He retired as a lieutenant colonel. And he wrote to me in it, and Walter brought me this book. For Murray Taylor, with all good wishes on behalf of every triple nickeler living and dead, keep up your splendid work and count on us for support, and we welcome you the same. Brad Biggs, North Palm Beach, Florida, 1996.
Okay, so you just read that note, that handwritten note, both of those, out of that book. What's the name of the book?
The Triple Nickels.
And who wrote it?
Bradley Biggs, Lieutenant Colonel retired. Brad Biggs. You can go to Triple Nickels, Black Paratroopers, and you'll see it. There's a bunch of neat stuff online.
Okay, and you wrote a book as well.
I've written three books on fire and one on a political issue in the United States. But anyway, can I tell you a little bit about some of the romantic parts about this?
You
know, Bob has been doing some work to help get a feature-length feature film. Imagine these guys from Augusta, Georgia, from Baltimore, from Chicago, young guys. And I'll tell you, what they did to become a black unit was amazing. They knew they were up against a lot of pressure. Their PT was extra hard. They wanted to be so good. At one time, they even gave up profanity. They said, let's not cuss. They were spit and polished. One general came there. I forget his name. After reviewing him, and he turned and said to a cohort, he said, this is one of the most strapped-looking Army units I've ever seen.
Yeah,
they were so proud of themselves. And imagine these, I'm not going to say they were kids, they were in their mid-20s, flying west and then being told after all they had done and all the barriers they had achieved over, they're told that now they're going to get in an airplane and parachute, not in a field to go to combat. They're going to parachute in the mountains, in the ridges, in the rock piles of the Northwest to put fires out.
That is amazing.
And they took it up just like that, and the experience turned them on just like it turns a lot of people on. They loved it, really.
And when you mentioned the PT, the physical training, they were in top physical
shape. They were in top physical when they arrived. You know, and they had to be, or else they would have been hurt a lot. If you look at pictures in this book and online, they were not given proper safety stuff. I mean, that was 45. That was 80 years ago. And even the regular jumpers didn't have the best stuff then. But they actually jumped in those old sheepskin flight suits that the pilots wore to keep warm in the airplanes.
Yeah, you know, there's a video, an 8-minute video on Southern Oregon PBS has on their website, and we link to it through our website. And Bob Bartlett is actually telling that story, and we get to see what those troopers look like.
Yeah, that's. I'm glad to hear that. I see the pickup, one picture of them out in front of their plane, standing all side by side.
Yeah.
I don't know. They were only dressed in their fatigues then, and they did not have any pads. And I'm telling you, Mike, to jump, and they only had 50-foot ropes. We jumped with 150-foot ropes. And it was only tied on the side of their harness. Imagine coming down in a tree with that rope dangling around. Ours was in a sealable little leg pocket on the side. So these boys, I don't want to call them boys, they're full-grown men for sure, but I often think of them, they're so young. But, you know, they took that up with such courage and such commitment. I hope there could be a movie. You know, Walter Morris's fiance, she drove all the way out to Pendleton from Chicago in a Model A Ford by herself to visit Walter. And I can imagine a movie with a picnic up in the Blue Mountains of Walter and Sally was her name. And
Dr. Bartlett, you you were featured in this video that I saw on Southern Oregon PBS. When Murray talks about a feature film, is that even in the realm of possibility?
It's always in the realm of possibilities, I would like to think. My colleague at the university, we did the short film in hopes that we could stir some interest in someone greenlighting a full feature documentary on it. We weren't successful at that back then, but there's new interest now by a different group in doing a documentary.
Okay.
So it could happen.
Okay.
What Murray and I talked about is really a film, a movie, right? Similar to the Tuskegee Airmen or Glory, where you had actors and playing parts, and it's a full story.
Gotcha.
My focus and hope, and also this company that just recently notified me, is that we're able to do a historical documentary film. There's none. And so we just, that's the hope, and it's still out there.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I just want to mention, you know, this, Mike, this story, as Murray told you, and he and I could talk for hours, just he and I, about it, but this story is so amazing. You know, it would be a shame if the last of the Triple Nickel, which right now there's only one still living who jumped out of Pendleton, if they did not live long enough to see this come to fruition. You know, it's that's the thing that drives me. And as I've said before in writing, I feel a genetic connection to this story, and I'm committed to it. And as long as I can continue to, you know, try to raise it to the level it deserves.
Okay, well,
but there's so much complications in place here. I appreciate the chance to visit with you.
We are running out of time. So, Murray, you had something you wanted to say very quickly. You got about 30 seconds.
Okay, the Oregon Geographic Name Board recently changed the name of Negro Creek in Douglas County to Triple Nickels Creek. The federal maps will be updated. Malvin Brown was killed August 6, 1945, making a letdown on the fire in the Umpqua National Forest. Bob Zyback, associate of the NSA, was the key person in getting the name changed. Thanks to Bob for your work.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Thank you both.